So in this class, we're going to talk about black holes, gravitational waves, some aspects of some sort of advanced aspects of Einstein's theory of general relativity, in particular focusing on the regime where space-time is highly dynamic and strongly curved. So first, just a couple notes on logistics. You know, so we're going to have lectures here for the next 5 weeks. Please feel free to ask lots of questions during the lectures. You know, we're a small group, it's going to have lots of interaction. You know, often I'll write something wrong on the board. Please correct me so we can fix it. And so in addition to the lectures, there's going to be six tutorials. I think the first one starts a week from today. So if you have trouble making any of the tutorials, talk to the Sci Fellow, Giuseppe, or the TA, who's going to be Max Corman for this class. In the lectures, I'm not going to discuss anything having to do with numerics or things like that. But for some of the tutorials, there'll be some sort of mild numerical work just at the level of integrating ordinary differential equations. So hopefully everyone knows how to do that with, you know, their favorite program, whether it be Mathematica or some Python or Maple or something like that. Maybe you could raise your hand if if I give you a simple set of ordinary differential equations, you would know how to integrate those numerically. So who's done that before? Okay, most of you. If you haven't done that, maybe we can, you can either talk to one of your classmates or try to look up the function on your favorite mathematical program, or we could also maybe prepare a little introduction to that before the first tutorial. So as I mentioned, the TA for this class will be Max Corman, and the Sci Fellow is Giuseppe Celeroni. And there will, in addition to the lectures and the tutorials, there'll be two problem sets. Okay, so one thing I want to emphasize in this course is sort of that, you know, given the recent detections by LIGO and Virgo of gravitational waves, you know, we're starting to see the gravitational waves from merging black holes and neutron stars, you know, we're really entering this sort of exciting new era. We can see the dynamics of space-time. So the point of this class is sort of to introduce all the sort of concepts and machinery that we need to, go from just thinking of, you know, black holes as these objects that exist eternally forever and a sort of background in which things happen, to thinking of them as dynamical entities that can form, that can merge, that can produce gravitational waves, and really thinking of Einstein's equations as telling us about dynamics, about, you know, starting from some initial conditions and going forward in time and telling us what happens and what we observe from that. We are going to sort of start a little bit slow, and the first sort of section of the class will spend a lot of time talking about the Kerr black hole and geodesics on that. And the reason for that, I'll go into a little bit more later, but basically a lot of the intuition you can gain just from studying the Kerr black hole will actually carry over to the dynamical setting. But then the next week, or the next sort of section, we'll talk about how you can take Einstein's equations and formulate them as a set of evolution equations, where you can start with some initial data and evolve it forward in time. We'll talk about how to define black hole horizons in dynamical settings. We'll talk about gravitational waves and how they're sourced. So any questions so far? Okay, so I'm assuming that everyone here has had an introductory GR class. So first, I'm just going to have a very quick lightning review of basic context in GR, just to sort of fix conventions, make sure we're all on the same page. Thank you. So in this class, you know, since we're now advanced general relativists, we're going to use geometric units. That is, we're going to set g equals c equals to 1. So index conventions for indexing vectors and tensors. So I'm going to use a, b, c, d, and so on for four-dimensional space-time indices. And I'm going to use I, j, k, and so on for three-dimensional spatial indices. So for example, you know, four-dimensional vector, you have the time component and then the three spatial components. For our metric signature, since we're close to the East Coast, we'll use the East Coast metric signature. That's minus plus plus plus, you know, which is, happens to be the, you know, a totally arbitrary choice, which is also objectively the best metric signature. And so we can now use, so we can write the line element ds squared in terms of the metric GAB, given some choice of coordinates here. And once we have a metric, we can use that to calculate Christoffel symbols. So those are defined in terms of derivatives of the metric the following way. And we note that we flip these indices, we just flip this guy with this guy, and that one remains the same, so it's symmetric under these indices. And then once we have these Christoffel symbols, then we can use those to define our covariant derivative. So if we take a covariant derivative of a tensor with sort of arbitrary upper and lower indices, first we just have the ordinary partial derivative. And then we need to contract our Christoffel symbols. With every one of our indices. So, we get a plus sign for all the upper indices and then a minus sign for the lower ones. And so on for all these other indices. And one property of this covariant derivative is that it's so-called compatible with our metric. That just means that if we take the covariant derivative of our metric, it's zero. So we can use these covariant derivatives to define the Riemann tensor. So basically, if we look at these covariant derivatives don't necessarily commute on an arbitrary spacetime manifold. So we can look at that commutator applied to an arbitrary vector v. And then we're going to use this to define our Riemann tensor. In this way. And so if you work out what you get applied to an arbitrary vector in terms of these Christoffel symbols, you'll get the following. You're going to get two partial derivatives of the Christoffel symbol terms. And then we'll get two sort of Christoffel squared terms. Okay, and we can check that we did that right. So if we flip these indices, we should just get a minus sign. So flipping these indices should just give us a minus sign. And we can check that if we flip A and B, this one goes to that one, so we get a minus sign. And same if we flip A and B here. All right. So now that we have the Riemann tensor, we can define several other tensors in terms of it. So there's the Ricci tensor. That we get just by contracting two of the indices. And then we can get a Ricci scalar. By taking the trace of this. And finally, we can define the Einstein tensor. In terms of the Ricci tensor and the Ricci scalar. And now we're ready to write down Einstein's equations. Just this, that the Einstein tensor is equal to 8 pi times the stress energy tensor. So you can note that, written this way, if we don't put any restrictions on what kind of matter we have, we can basically get any solution we want, right? We can think of some arbitrary metric you know, calculate its Einstein tensor, just divide that by 8 pi, say I have that matter, and that would technically be a solution to the Einstein equations, right? So basically, you need to put some requirements on your stress energy tensor in order to have any sort of requirements on what kind of solutions would be physically allowed. So just as one example of a stress energy tensor, I can consider the stress energy tensor of a perfect fluid. So that's given by, so here rho is the energy density of the fluid and its rest frame. P is its pressure. UA would be the forward velocity of the fluid. So that's the stress energy tensor of a fluid. And there are many different energy conditions one could put that might be more or less stringent or more or less physically motivated. I'll briefly mention one right now, which is the so-called null energy condition. And that is the requirement that we take our stress energy tensor and we contract it with K, where K is a future pointing null vector. Then this has to be greater than or equal to zero. So if we can apply this condition, for example, to a perfect fluid, we can note that, you know, by the definition of null, if we contract this with this one, it just gives zero. So we just get this term here. So you can see it just gives a mild condition that basically this addition of the pressure plus the energy density has to be greater than or equal to zero. And one other thing about the stress energy tensor is we know that it needs to be conserved. And you can just deduce that from the fact that, using the Bianchi identity, if we take the covariant derivative of GAB, that's going to give us zero. So the stress energy tensor, so let it be conserved, because when you apply the covariant derivative here, you should also get zero. Yep.
Could you change the k off of here from being the future point like null vector to like time vector? I remember it was we could define like the exotic matters and the non-exotic matter, but like I don't remember the condition's name.
To be honest, I off the top of my head, I mean, there's whatever the dominant energy condition, there's like the weak energy condition. Off the top of my head, I always get those slightly confused too. Yeah, so I mentioned this one. I mean, yeah, there's definitely a number of them. The reason why this one is particularly useful, you can see, is that basically if we make this requirement, and then we require that we're satisfying the Einstein equations, then we basically get this condition on the Ricci tensor, and that will turn out to be useful for proving some properties of, for example, when you have horizons and things like that. So that's why that's particularly useful. But yeah, there's definitely a number of them. Any other questions? Yeah, so that was kind of the lightning review of general relativity. So hopefully that was all something that y'all have seen before. For the rest of the today and the next several lectures, we're going to focus on the Kerr solution, which describes isolated rotating black hole. And we'll talk sort of some about the dynamics that can happen on this Kerr spacetime. So you might ask, what's so special about the Kerr solution? Why are we going to spend so many lectures discussing it? To answer that, I'd like to read this quote from Chandrasekhar, who's one of the pioneers of relativity. So he said, "In my entire scientific life, extending over 45 years, the most shattering experience has been the realization that an exact solution of Einstein's equations of general relativity, discovered by the New Zealand mathematician Roy Kerr, provides the absolute exact representation of untold numbers of massive black holes that populate the universe." Let's try to unpack that a little bit. So what does Chandrasekhar mean by that? So it turns out the Kerr black hole solution actually turns out to be the only possible stationary vacuum black hole solution. This is a result going back to sort of the work of Israel, Carter, Hawking in the 1960s and 70s. Later, when we start to talk about gravitational waves, we'll talk about what happens when you perturb a black hole. But the punchline is that if you perturb a black hole, they actually their perturbations die down rapidly. Actually, in sort of the light crossing time of the black hole. And at least as far as we know, the final state of any sort of generic collapse is a black hole. So this is one of the many conjectures of Penrose, the so-called final state conjecture. But in many examples that we looked at, you take any sort of generic distribution of matter, once it collapses far enough, you form a Kerr black hole. And in particular, that's parameterized by two numbers. It's mass and it's angular momentum. And so you get just a black hole and then some gravitational radiation that escapes to infinity. And so this is the so-called no-hair property of black holes, that they're just determined by these two numbers. Of course, we can also add, if one considers the Maxwell-Einstein equations, one can also add charge. So that in this case, you would also have the charge of the black hole, but we don't think that is particularly relevant for astrophysical black holes. Their charge is pretty negligible, so I'm not going to mention that in the rest of the class.
Wait, this is no hair again, which is the best number.
Basically the black hole can be you know, once it's relaxed down to its final state, can just be determined by its mass and its spin. Basically, it's like doesn't have any. it doesn't have any extra parameters. Like for other objects, you could imagine they sort of retain some special memory of like what happened when they. You know, the sort of object that went into forming them or something like that. You know, so they could have, you know, some clouds around them or some other parameters that determine them, that they're due to what matter made up them. But for black holes, we think that basically there's just these, you know, couple numbers, and that determines the whole space-time.
Stationary vacuum black hole solution. Just I hear recently that there could be solutions with higher multiple moments, which still is solution to Einstein's equation. So it means that they are not black hole anymore. If they want to be, because if it has higher multiple moments, then I think they must not care, right?
Right. But those are black hole solutions without.
Yeah. So it means that they are not black holes.
Yeah, or they're not in GR or something like that. Yeah.
So what does it mean to be black hole solutions? Just we are terming we are addressing existence of horizon.
That they have a horizon basically. Yeah.
It means that if there is any other solution to Einstein's equation, which is a still solution to Einstein's equation, but other than chair, then it's not a black hole.
Yeah, as long as it's you know, stationary too. I mean, you can certainly have like a dynamically formed black hole might have these higher multiple perturbations, but then they'll sort of relax down. Or if you have like a, you know, a star or something like that, then you can have these higher or these other multiple moments that don't agree with Kerr.
Essentially just means
as
much components are time in the back.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So yeah, a rotating black hole would be stationary but not static, but a non-rotating black hole would be static and stationary. Yeah, so we're gonna write down the metric for Kerr and a particular set of coordinates called Bohr-Lindquist coordinates. Line element looks like the following. So that's the line element. I have to define a couple of these things. So this sigma is given by this. And so here,
by dimension analysis, like delta is r squared, right, and a squared and dimension 4 of r, and then it's r squared.
Sorry, say that again?
With g5i, it's r squared plus a squared, right?
g5i.
It's also sigma, yeah, like r squared plus a squared times sigma minus delta.
Oh, yeah, you're right, there we go. Yeah. Yeah, thank you. All right, anything else? Yeah, so here I introduced this A parameter. So that's the angular momentum of the black hole divided by its mass. And then I'm going to use A bar to denote the dimensionless spin of the black hole. That's angular momentum divided as mass squared. Sometimes you see people use A for this one instead, or sometimes you see people use chi instead of A bar for this dimensionless spin. But yeah, so here A has the same dimensions as mass or radius in our geometric units. Yeah, so you know, even though this looks fairly complicated, you know, the nice thing about the metric and Boyer Lindquist units, and the reason we're going to use it to do some calculations, even though as we'll mention in a little bit, it has some problems, but the reason it's particularly nice is that it's basically the only off diagonal term. That's the only term that you know, if you were at the metric as a matrix that would be off diagonal is this GT G phi term. So the spatial part is just a diagonal metric, and you just have this mixing between the T and phi components. Right, so we can consider, can y'all see if I write here or should I avoid writing there? Yeah, we can consider a couple different limits of this. So, you know, the first one is just if we set the spin to zero, then we get the Schwarzschild solution that just describes a non-rotating black hole. And in particular, you see that this term will go away, and it actually becomes spherically symmetric. So a slightly more complicated limit is to consider what happens if instead we fix a bar, but then we let the mass go to zero. So if we do that, get the following metric. So that may be a little bit non-intuitive because I think we set the mass to zero, we should just get flat space. But in fact, the claim is that this is actually just the flat space Minkowski metric, but it just happens to be in sort of a non-standard set of coordinates. So one can show actually that with a suitable coordinate redefinition, we can actually put this in the usual form for Minkowski. So that's the following So these are actually called ellipsoidal coordinates. So you see that you can, you know, check for yourself that if you do this coordinate transformation, you actually just end up with Minkowski space and Cartesian coordinates. But you can see here that, you know, phi is just the usual azimuthal angle. Theta is this polar angle. But here we're actually map that r equals 0 in these coordinates actually gets mapped to this ring. So of x squared plus y squared equals a squared. And so that's something important to remember. But these are called ellipsoidal coordinates. So even in flat space, these Borel-Lindquists, even in flat space, if we keep this A, our coordinates become ellipsoidal.
I'm trying to understand this bit of a physical intuition of this. Like, you know, when you're actually seeing the metric, right, like the coordinates, for instance, you can actually see the aerial coordinates really is, for instance, adaptable, right? And I'm just wondering how is that going to be? I can imagine you have this very small object that you can use really fast, so we can see some of the deviations in that. But I'm just trying to see if that's going to be any different. Because you have still an aerial coordinate over there, right? And then when we are defining the coordinate x, y, and z, we are not doing the aerial coordinate, right? So I'm just trying to understand, like, what is x?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say there's not really that much physics here. It's just, so this metric really is just the same as Minkowski, but it's just a different set of coordinates that turn out to be useful for describing curved black holes. The point I want to emphasize here is just that, in these coordinates, basically, r equals 0 is not just a point, but it's actually this ring.
But is it a detectable ring? That's not exactly my question. This is reference y squared equal to a squared. Is it like the ring that at least, you know, when it comes to ring, it reminds me of a clear space time that, you know, we have like a ring-like structure when we're looking at the theta equal to pi half, or like when we're looking at it, like, based on the table 0, we don't see the similarity. It's just like,
you know,
I'm just saying, you know, is it like...
Yeah. So I think you're anticipating the next thing we're talking about, but yeah, exactly. So exactly the fact that you'll get this singularity, as we'll talk about shortly at r equals 0, and Kerr, this singularity is not a point, it's this ring that'll be determined by this.
How come fix A and then take the limit of n to 0? I mean, is A single defined? Because it's j over n, right? And then what does it mean? Because I'm thinking that now A is super big.
Sorry, it's what?
So it's super large because, so the definition of A is angular momentum over n.
Right.
If n goes to 0, then A is not
well defined. We can just imagine, like, I mean, another way to think of this is just your, you're very small, very far away from this object or something like that, right? In this limit, you do just end up with flat space because, because basically, you know, you're letting the mass go to 0, and then even if you keep this a bar fixed, your angular momentum will also go to 0, right? But we're just taking this particular limit that ends up with these coordinates. I mean, we could also just let them both go to 0, and then you would just get the usual spherical polar coordinates. Good. Any other questions? All right. Yeah, so next we're going to talk about the symmetries of our Kerr solution. So the Kerr metric, it turns out, has two killing vectors. So first, let's remind ourselves what it means for a vector to be killing. So we say some vector k is a killing vector if, when we take the lead derivative with respect to k of the metric, then we get 0. And so just to remind you what the lead derivative is, so for a general tensor, just get the partial derivative in the direction of k, and so here I've defined the killing vector in terms of these partial derivatives, but you can also, you can actually show that if you just replace the partial derivatives with the covariant derivatives, you actually get an expression that's equal to this, and that's basically because the difference between these two, the Christoffel symbols, will cancel out when you put it together in this term. So you can check that yourself. So this is the general definition, but if we now make this substitution, and
less g on PCA or less g?
Yes, thanks. Yeah, so if we make this substitution and then use the fact that our covariant derivative is metric compatible, then we can get rid of this first term. And then we're basically just left with this, or using this symmetrization notation. It's equal to that. So that's just using the fact that if I change this guy to a covariant derivative, that term disappears. So a vector is a killing vector if basically this is equal to 0. So we take a look here at expression for Kerr and Borelinkus coordinates, we can note that all the metric components are independent of t, of time, and they're independent of phi, the azimuthal coordinate. So that means we can actually define two killing vectors according to those symmetries of Kerr. So the first one is azimuthal killing vector, just in the azimuthal direction. And so the symmetry associated with this killing vector is just axisymmetry. And so I'll use t hat for the killing vector that's time-like at infinity. So that's the one associated with the space-time being stationary. So, you know, one thing to note is that though the Kerr metric is, you know, independent of time, if we let t go to minus t, we do change because of this dt d phi component. So the Kerr spacetime is not static. It's stationary, though. So I don't know if you always get that confused like I do. You can think of stationary as like a, you know, stationary exercise bike. You're spinning and you're spinning, but you're not changing or you're not going anywhere. Whereas static means it's not moving at all. So yeah, and I can briefly mention that in addition to these killing vectors, Kerr actually also has a killing tensor. And so that just means you have some tensor that satisfies this condition. So you can see basically just added one more index to there. Now we get this killing tensor. So I'm not going to write down the full expression for that. Maybe I just want to write that down. So I'm not going to write down the full expression for that, but basically this, the killing tensor is associated with another conserved quantity called the Carter constant. But in the next couple lectures, we're going to talk about mainly geodesics that sort of orbit in the equatorial plane. And in that case, the Carter constant will just be associated with the fact that if you start in the equator, you stay in the equator. But sort of for more complicated orbits around Kerr black holes, this associated symmetry can be useful. But we won't use it for the rest of the class.
Any vector defined by vectors on which you translate metric time will be invariant?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know if there's a simple way to put that in terms of Lie derivatives. I guess probably.
Because that's not obvious. Obviously,
it's a Yeah, I mean, it's a little more in depth. I mean, so we'll go through how having the killing vector will give rise to a quantity that's conserved along geodesics. But yeah, it's a little bit more complicated how to go from this killing tensor to conserved quantities. Yeah, but that's a good question. Maybe we'll talk about it next time. Any other questions? All right, so these Boyer-Lenkos coordinates, if we stare at them a little bit, we can see that they break down, that the metric components become undefined at two places.
One obvious solution for that is just the way you would have a measure of metric because of metric compatibility. So does it have a unit solution? Like, do we only have one killing tensor?
No, I mean, yeah, I mean, you're right. The metric tensor itself would be a killing tensor. But yeah, then I guess additional ones. There turns out to be sort of another killing tensor that's not equal to the metric that also has a conserved quantity associated with it. So I mean, yeah, I can just, so this one that I was mentioning that's associated with this Carter constant, is equal to like R squared plus GAB, and then where this L and N are two null vectors, which I won't write down. But yeah, so you can see it's something that's distinct from the metric. Yeah, so if we stare at the Kerr metric and Borelinkowitz coordinates, we can see that the metric components become ill-defined in two places. So one of them is when this sigma is equal to 0, because we're dividing things by sigma, and the other one is where delta is equal to 0. So it turns out that this delta equal to 0 actually corresponds to a true physical singularity. We're not going to go through the calculation, but one can show that, for example, if one calculates what's called the Kretschmann scalar, it's where you contract the Riemann tensor with itself, that actually blows up as you approach sigma equals 0. And so using the expression for sigma, we can see that sigma equals 0 is equivalent to R squared plus A squared cosine squared being equal to 0. So that happens when R equals 0 and theta equals pi over 2. But as we kind of already alluded to, we shouldn't really think of this as a point because we're in these kind of ellipsoidal like coordinates. We should really think of this as a ring singularity that occurs, you know, in the equator, and then for this ring, which in Cartesian-like coordinates would be equal to a squared. So maybe in a little bit, I'll write down the Kerr solution in Cartesian-like coordinates, and we can see that in fact this intuition that we had from the flat space case actually carries over here too. But before we get to that, you should note that, you know, even before we reach sigma equals 0, there's another place where the coordinates break down, and that's where delta equals to 0. And so that's going to actually turn out to be the horizon of our black hole. So it turns out that in these particular coordinates, to find the horizon of our black hole, we can actually just consider surfaces of constant radius. And we basically want to calculate the character of these surfaces, whether they're space-like, time-like, or null. So the normal to a surface of constant radius would just be given by that, just the derivative with respect to the radius. And so if we want to see if that's time-like, space-like, or null, we would just contract it with itself. And so the surface being null, would just be equivalent to this being equal to zero, which is the same as GRR equal being equal to zero. It's just the metric with upper indices, metric inverse. And that's equal to this. So so basically the surface of constant R become null when delta equals to zero. And so there are actually two values where this happens. We can factorize our expression for delta right here into two radii, which I call R plus and R minus, which are given by the two roots, this quadratic. And so these are called the outer and inner horizon. So you can note that for large R, this R is a space-like coordinate. It's, you know, just a large R just becomes the usual spherical radius. Then as we pass through this R plus, at R plus it becomes null, and then inside actually becomes time-like. And then it will switch again when we get to this R minus. So it actually defines an event horizon in the sense that once you cross this R equals to R plus, you have to move towards smaller radius, just like we have to move forward in time. One thing to note though is that if we have so much angular momentum that A bar is greater than A, then actually we don't have any real roots to this expression, right? So if our dimensionless bin is greater than 1, then we have no horizon. We will have a singularity still, so actually this a Kerr solution with dimensionless bin greater than 1 actually corresponds to naked singularity. So we don't think those occur in nature, and in fact, as we'll discuss later, and I think you'll work out in some of the homeworks, spinning black holes actually tend to resist any effort to spin them up beyond this so-called extremal limit, where the dimensionless bin becomes greater than 1. Okay, so I think we're about out of time, so let me just stop here and ask if we have any questions. So I think on the course description there's a some suggested reading for each set of lectures. So yeah, for this first part, if you have a copy of Wald, this would roughly correspond to the material in chapter 8 is what I'll cover first on black holes. Okay, any other questions?
Yeah. Can you explain again the R concept now? Or what is that vector?
Yeah, so and just saying, if you take if you want to, you have some surface and then you want to determine if you want to determine the character of that surface, you can look at the normal to that surface and see whether that normal is time-like, space-like, or null. And so if you have a surface of constant coordinate, the normal is just given by taking the gradient of that level surface, right? So this is just the normal to the surface as a constant R, and then we're checking whether the normal, so like if this is zero, it's null. You know, if it's positive, it's space-like. If it's negative, it's time-like. Yep.
Is this enough for us to define the horizon, or do we need like other constraints on our, like, can we identify the black hole horizon just by requiring this?
Yeah, no, I mean, so next time I'll talk, I mean, this shows that it, you know, basically is a horizon. It's a bound, like this is a null surface, and outside of it you can move outward to infinity, and inward you have to fall in. But not all coordinates, like even you can have Kerr in different coordinates where the horizon will be sort of a constant radius. And then in dynamical situations, yeah, it can be much more complicated in terms of determining where the event horizon is. And we'll discuss that later in the course. But basically, in the fully dynamical setting, to determine the event horizon, you basically need to know the whole feature of the space-time. And so we'll also talk about some ways you can sort of locally define what it means to have a black hole horizon. All right, well, see you on Thursday.